What if one of the most globally recognized reggae anthems didn't come from Bob Marley, but from a band who stood in Marley's shadow, survived unimaginable tragedy, and still plays to crowds in 2025? Long before Bad Boys became a cultural slogan, Inner Circle was already shaping the pulse of Kingston's revolutionary soundtrack. Formed in the chaotic, soul-rich trenches of 1960s Jamaica, Inner Circle wasn't just another reggae band. They were pioneers, survivors, architects of a sound that fused rebellion, joy, and global rhythms. With the unforgettable Jacob Miller at their helm, they didn't just play music, they lit fires. And when tragedy nearly destroyed them, they rebuilt, in exile, in pain, and with a clarity of purpose that would shock even their critics. From the ghettos of Kingston to the stadiums of Germany, from Rasta spirituality to 90s pop stardom, this is the untold legacy of Inner Circle, a story of cultural resilience, sonic rebellion, and the unstoppable rhythm of the Caribbean spirit. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, The Pulse of Kingston, 1968 to 1970, Birth of Inner Circle, Kingston, Jamaica. The summer of 1968 wasn't merely hot, it was electric. The air buzzed with possibility, unrest, and the unpredictable beat of a city waking up to its own power. Independence from Britain was only 6 years old, but the cultural and political soul of Jamaica was still fighting for true identity. On street corners and in smoky sound systems hidden behind zinc fences, a new language was forming, and its name was reggae. This was no accident. Reggae emerged as the voice of the people, the soundtrack of resistance. It took the rock-steady rhythm, slowed it down, infused it with soul, and embedded a heartbeat that pulsed with struggle, faith, and freedom. It wasn't just music. It was a coded message, carried through the streets of Trenchtown, echoed in the hills of St. Andrew, and blasted from cassettes in every dancehall yard across the island. Among the teenagers soaking in this new rhythm were Ian and Roger Lewis, two brothers born with music in their bones. Raised in Kingston, they watched the shifting culture around them, the rise of Marcus Garvey-inspired black consciousness, the spread of Rastafarianism, and the political powder keg that threatened to erupt at any moment. But more than anything, they felt the music. Roger played bass like he was anchoring a ship through a storm. Ian picked up rhythm guitar and soon began writing, arranging, thinking in patterns and phrases, the way a sculptor sees shapes in marble. They weren't prodigies, not yet. They were simply obsessed, and that obsession, paired with a burning sense of purpose, would soon give birth to a band that would defy death, exile, and the odds of cultural erasure. The streets were the studio. Kingston had no shortage of raw talent. From Lee Scratch Perry to Studio One's stable of future stars, the capital city was overflowing with young men and women desperate to translate their reality into rhythm. But opportunity, that was scarce. Still, the Lewis brothers found themselves in circles where music was both salvation and revolution. They connected with keyboardist Stephen Cat Core, who would later join Third World, guitarist Michael Ebo Cooper, and others who were exploring how to blend roots reggae with funk, soul, and jazz. This wasn't purism. This was innovation. The earliest version of Inner Circle wasn't even called Inner Circle. They were a loose collective of musicians playing wherever they could, school halls, beachside clubs, church socials. At first, it was covers, American soul, Motown, James Brown. Then came the reinterpretations. What if Curtis Mayfield met Naya Bingi drumming? What if Otis Redding was Rastafarian? Their name would come soon, and with it, a vision. Inner Circle, a name with weight. In 1968, the Lewis brothers officially named the band Inner Circle, symbolizing a tight-knit unit with shared values, not just musical, but spiritual. The name implied intimacy, trust, a kind of secret bond between performers and listeners. The circle was a cipher of ancient Africa, the heartbeat of drum rituals, and the safe space where truth could be spoken without shame. This was no industry gimmick. Inner Circle saw themselves as cultural missionaries, young, ambitious, but grounded in the belief that music was not just entertainment, it was testimony. They quickly built a reputation as a tight, genre-blending live act. While Bob Marley and the Wailers were still navigating their transition from ska to roots reggae, Inner Circle was already leaning into complex arrangements, vocal harmonies, and a rhythm section that could rival any American funk band. But they lacked a voice, that singular, unforgettable frontman who could set them apart. Enter Jacob Miller, Almost. In these early years, a teenager named Jacob Miller was already on the radar in Kingston, with a rich baritone that felt far older than his years, and a charisma that could part crowds. He was the missing piece, but not yet. That meeting would come a few years later. For now, Inner Circle focused on refining their sound, performing at venues like the Glass Bucket Club and hotels along the coast. The music industry in Jamaica was small, but interconnected. Producers like Joe Gibbs, Coxon Dodd, and Derek Harriet held the keys to exposure. Inner Circle navigated this maze strategically, always aware that their unique fusion might alienate traditionalists, but could electrify international audiences. They began recording, nothing yet chart-shattering, but enough to cement them as serious contenders in the evolving reggae movement. The Sound of Rebellion. What made Inner Circle different in 1968 to 1970 wasn't just their talent, it was their philosophy. They weren't interested in fame for fame's sake. They were watching their peers, many from their own neighborhoods, be silenced by political violence, poverty, and a system that commodified Jamaican culture while denying its creators equity. Inner Circle wanted to disrupt that. Their early songs, many now hard to find, buried in analog archives, spoke of liberation, dignity, and unity. They infused their music with the spiritual language of Rastafari without being dogmatic. They praised Haile Selassie Tante in one breath and railed against Babylon in the next. But they were also fun. Their sets could veer from militant to jubilant within a single performance. This duality, revolution and rhythm, roots and joy, would become a signature. They didn't have a major label. They didn't have a global stage. But they had the pulse of Kingston in their hands, and they played it like a weapon. Laying the foundation. By 1970, Inner Circle was no longer just a band. They were a movement, young, fearless, and determined to carry reggae beyond the confines of genre and geography. The foundation was set. The circle was formed, and the journey had begun. They didn't know that within a few short years, tragedy would strike. They didn't know they would one day write a song that would define global pop culture for decades. All they knew was that Kingston was alive, and they were ready to make it sing. Chapter 2, Reggae Rising, a new sound for a change in Jamaica. It was 1971, and Jamaica was trembling. Not with fear, but with energy. The island had become a living soundscape. Rhythms poured from every window, blasted from every corner shop, rolled down hills into marketplaces, and pulsed through the spines of restless young people, hungry for more than what independence alone had delivered. The nation was technically free, but the ghost of colonialism still haunted its institutions, its economy, its people. And that's when reggae truly began to rise. Inner Circle stood among the few bands at the forefront of this evolution, not just observing the transformation of Jamaican music, but shaping it. Where ska had once set a fast swinging pace and rocksteady introduced smoother melodies, reggae slowed things down, made space for reflection, for message, for spiritual rebellion. The early 1970s was reggae's teenage phase. Bold, volatile, expressive, an Inner Circle was among its most experimental, soulful, and fearless practitioners. a sound to speak for the people. The streets of Kingston were alive with music, but also danger. Political violence was rising. The two main parties, the People's National Party, PNP, and the Jamaica Labour Party, JLP, had weaponized loyalty, creating rival zones within the city. Guns, many imported from the Cold War superpowers, flooded the ghettos. Political gangs became enforcers, and turf wars stained the very streets Inner Circle walked to rehearsal. But reggae didn't flinch. In fact, reggae responded by getting louder, not in volume, but in intention. Bands like the Wailers were beginning to gain international attention with their Island Records deal. Toots and the Maytales, Jimmy Cliff, and Burning Spear were creating timeless anthems rooted in pain, prophecy, and protest. Inner Circle, still young, still developing their sound, refused to be sidelined. Their early recordings reflected a band unafraid to blend roots reggae with elements of soul, funk, and jazz. They were not purists. They were innovators. Roger Lewis's bass line thumped with discipline and bounce. Ian's guitar chopped like a machete through Babylon's lies. But what they needed was a vocal identity, a frontman who could elevate their instrumentation into revolutionary testimony. They needed Jacob Miller. Jacob Miller returns. Jacob Miller had recorded his first song, Love is a Message, at the age of 13. By the early 1970s, he was already something of a prodigy, known for his massive smile, confident swagger, and a voice that was deep, rich, and intoxicating. He embodied the paradox of reggae itself, joyful and haunted, wise and playful, spiritual and streetwise. Inner Circle had encountered Jacob before. They had watched him grow up in the industry, hopping between studios, leaving an impression everywhere. But it wasn't until 1974 that fate and mutual ambition aligned, when Jacob Miller officially joined Inner Circle as their lead singer. The alchemy clicked. They weren't just a tight band anymore. They were a movement with a prophet at the microphone. The Jacob Miller Effect. Jacob transformed Inner Circle from a respected reggae fusion outfit into a spiritual and cultural powerhouse. He was more than a singer. He was a messenger. His vocal tone could shift from velvety croon to apocalyptic chant within a single phrase. His stage presence was magnetic. He didn't perform for the audience. He preached to them. And his personality, larger than life. He was a known prankster offstage, full of jokes, loud laughter, and unexpected wisdom. But on stage and in the studio, he was dead serious about the message. Rastafari teachings flowed through his lyrics. Songs like Tenement Yard and Tired Fi Liquid in a Bush weren't just catchy. They were sermons disguised as grooves. The band's name, Inner Circle, suddenly took on deeper meaning. With Jacob, they weren't just inside the circle of reggae music. They were inside the spiritual consciousness of a generation. The message in the music. Inner Circle didn't chase chart positions. They chased truth. They addressed poverty, systemic violence, police brutality, and spiritual warfare. Their rhythms made you move, but their words made you think. With Jacob in front, the band began pushing out songs that were equal parts philosophy and fire. The whole thing about music is not just for you to dance, Jacob once said in an interview. It's to tell people what's really going on. Their influence spread fast. Radio DJs championed them. Sound system selectors dropped their records in the early hours when the crowd was just high enough to listen. Political organizers began using their songs as rallying cries. Rastafarians saw Jacob as a bridge between street life and Zion. Their live shows were unlike anything else. Drums pulsed like a heartbeat. Roger's bass wrapped around the crowd like a vine. Ian's guitar carried coded messages. Jacob stood in the center, smiling, preaching, sweating, daring Babylon to take notice. A new Jamaica, a new voice. By 1975, Inner Circle was no longer local. They had become ambassadors of a new Jamaica, one that was complicated, deeply spiritual, Politically volatile and utterly alive, reggae wasn't just a Jamaican export anymore. It was becoming a global movement. An inner circle was helping build the scaffolding that would carry it beyond the Caribbean. With Marley rising in parallel, the world was finally listening. But within Jamaica, Inner Circle had earned respect not for how much they sold, but for how much they spoke truth. Their lyrics became oral history. Their rhythms became rituals, and their circle was just beginning to widen. Chapter 3, The Miller Arrival, Jacob, Charisma, and Revolution. Jacob Miller didn't walk into Inner Circle. He stormed in, barefoot, belly forward, laughing, and already legendary. He was Jamaica's most beloved contradiction, deeply spiritual, yet wildly irreverent. Rastafarian, yet delightfully profane. Disciplined in sound, yet rebellious in every other sense. His arrival in 1974 as the full-time lead vocalist wasn't just the beginning of a new musical chapter. It was the ignition point of cultural revolution. From the moment he joined the band, Inner Circle changed, not just in sound, but in soul. Jacob didn't fit into the band. He transformed it. The musicians had been polished, respected, and steadily building momentum. But Jacob, he was a force of nature, unpredictable and magnetic. His voice boomed from deep within, carrying the weight of ancestral memory and ghetto philosophy. His charisma could disarm even the most hardened street general, and his mind, sharp as a guillotine. To understand how Inner Circle came to embody the pulse of a nation, you must understand the lightning bolt that was Jacob Miller. Born to be wild. Born in 1952 in Mandeville, Jamaica, and raised primarily in Kingston, Jacob Miller was drawn to music like a moth to flame. As a child, he lingered around recording studios, volunteering to sweep floors just to catch a glimpse of the magic. By age 13, he'd recorded his first single, Love is a Message, for Clement Coxon Dodd at Studio One. Though the record didn't make waves at the time, his voice, that deep, honey-coated baritone, turned heads. People didn't just hear him, they felt him. In the years that followed, Jacob became a known figure in Kingston's music circles. He bounced between studios, worked odd jobs, and became a kind of underground sensation. He was always singing, in the yard, at street corners, in line for food, and always with a smile that made it impossible to forget him. By the time Ian and Roger Lewis brought him into the Inner Circle family, he was already a living legend in the making. Inner Circle becomes a lightning rod. The pairing of Jacob Miller with Inner Circle was more than talent meeting opportunity. It was destiny colliding with intention. With Jacob at the helm, the band crystallized into something transcendent. Their sound thickened, their identity sharpened. They stopped sounding like a talented reggae fusion band and started sounding like the heartbeat of Kingston itself. Songs like Tenement Yard spoke directly to ghetto realities. The opening lines, "Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement yard, too much watchy-watchy," weren't just clever lyrics, they were ghetto gospel. Jacob's delivery was playful, but razor sharp. He used patois like a weapon, coded language that both exposed hypocrisy and affirmed Rastafari values. He mocked societal divisions, poked fun at uptown behavior, and challenged Babylonian thinking without ever sounding bitter. The music, unstoppable. The live shows, electric. Audiences didn't just watch Inner Circle. They participated. They shouted back lyrics. They lit chalices in praise. They threw fists in the air in defiance. Jacob would tease, provoke, and then drop into a groove so heavy it shook your ribcage. The Rebel's Smile. Jacob had an unteachable gift. He could make the deepest truths digestible through laughter. His grin became a symbol, not just of joy, but of unbreakable spirit. In a time when many Rastas carried solemnity like armor, Jacob defied the image. He was loud. He cracked jokes. He laughed on stage. But he was no clown. He was a rebel in disguise. His joy was a form of resistance. His laughter was loaded. His stage antics were revolutionary theater. He challenged norms through contradiction. He could sing about the spiritual heights of Zion in one verse and make a sly joke about government corruption in the next. In the hands of someone less brilliant, this would feel chaotic. In Jacob's hands, it was orchestration. A voice for the voiceless. Jacob Miller became the soundtrack of the sufferer. He wasn't just speaking to the people, he was speaking as one of them. Inner Circle's music during this period reflected this identity shift. Their rhythms got deeper, the production more militant, the harmonies tighter. And while many bands were seeking crossover appeal, Inner Circle, with Jacob, doubled down on roots reggae, unpolished, unapologetic, and unfiltered. It wasn't long before the band found itself aligned with political energy. Though they avoided overt party affiliations, they were often booked at rallies and community events hosted by progressive organizers and radical intellectuals. Jacob's alignment with Rastafarianism only deepened this political undertone. He praised Haile Selassie III, invoked Ethiopia as a symbol of spiritual repatriation, and rejected the colonial leftovers still stinking up Jamaica's power structures. Musical firebombs. By 1976, Inner Circle was producing some of their most powerful recordings. While not always released under their direct name, sometimes under Jacob Miller's solo work with heavy backing from the band, the chemistry was undeniable. One standout, Forward Jah Jah Children, a sonic war cry against apathy and oppression. Another, Tired Fi Lick Weed in a Bush, a humorous but biting critique of marijuana criminalization. Jacob's songs weren't pro-weed in the shallow sense. They were coded critiques of the legal system, the surveillance state, and the cultural double standards imposed on Black Jamaicans. Inner Circle's sound was not only potent, it was prophetic. The golden era begins. The mid-1970s became what many reggae historians now call the golden era of Inner Circle. The band was in sync, Jacob was in his prime, and the world was beginning to pay attention. International promoters started calling. Europe was curious. Japan was listening. America was waking up. But in the eye of the storm, Jacob remained Jacob, laughing, smoking, chanting, creating. He had no interest in being polished for foreign markets. He had no time for cultural sanitization. He was the rebel with the radiant smile, and Inner Circle was his amplifier. And though no one knew it at the time, not the Lewis brothers, not Jacob himself, they were racing toward a cliff they wouldn't see until it was too late. The fire was burning hot, the revolution was loud, and the next chapter would change everything. Chapter 4. Jamaican Roots, Global Fire, the 1970s, Studio Vibe. The doors of Channel One Studio in Kingston didn't creak open. They breathed, thick with ganja smoke, bass reverb, and sweat. Inside, the walls pulsed with the ghosts of reggae greats, and the equipment, analog, raw, sacred, waited for the next beat to be born. This was the sound lab of the revolution. In the mid to late 1970s, Jamaica's music studios weren't just workspaces. They were sanctuaries, and sometimes battlegrounds. Each session was a confrontation between oppression and freedom, politics and prophecy, noise and harmony. For Inner Circle, now fronted by the dynamic Jacob Miller, the studio became a forge, melting cultural identity, international ambition, and Rastafari fire into something timeless. And Kingston was watching. The rise of studio culture. Reggae's ascent in the 1970s was fueled not only by talent, but by a studio system unlike anything else in the world. Producers like Joe Gibbs, Lee Scratch Perry, Errol Thompson, and Bunny Lee weren't just recording songs. They were curating sonic uprisings. Inner Circle found themselves in this ecosystem, not as followers, but as innovators. Their sessions were tight, intentional, and fiercely collaborative. They weren't content to simply jam. Ian and Roger Lewis approached each song like an engineer building a bridge. Every snare hit mattered. Every vocal harmony had purpose. And Jacob, He was unpredictable brilliance. Some days he'd walk in Solomon silent. Others he'd break into laughter, improvise half the lyrics on the spot, and still deliver a track so powerful, the engineers would sit in stunned silence. The global influence begins. By 1975 to 1977, reggae was beginning to cross borders in a new way. Bob Marley was touring Europe. Jimmy Cliff had already starred in The Harder They Come. Sound systems were popping up in the UK, and Japanese record buyers were starting to import vinyl straight from Kingston. Inner Circle's growing catalog, much of it recorded with Jacob, but sometimes credited to his solo releases, began to trickle into these markets. What set them apart was not just the content, but the craft. Songs like Healing of the Nation, Peace Treaty, and Forward Jar Jar Children weren't mass-produced. They were sculpted. Their approach to studio recording balanced roots authenticity with global sensibility. They used live horns, deep bass lines, complex rhythms, and layered backing vocals that hinted at Motown and soul influences, all while remaining rooted in the Niyabingi spirit of Rastafari. And still, they didn't lose the street. Their music played in Kingston's alleys and bars. Rude boys danced to it. Rastas reasoned to it. And as reggae radio stations gained traction abroad, Inner Circle became a name whispered in record stores from London to Lagos. The Inner Circle Sound. To define the Inner Circle Sound during this era is to trace a perfect balance between raw and refined. They embraced deep bass and sharp drums, the backbone of roots reggae, harmonized chants, spiritual, sometimes haunting, improvisational bridges, letting Jacob stretch into soul and jazz modes, political lyrics wrapped in melody, never too heavy-handed, but always clear. Unlike some of their peers, Inner Circle never felt obligated to ride a single wave. They could slide from militant tracks to lover's rock, from ceremonial odes to playful tunes, and do it all while remaining unmistakably themselves. Jacob was a chameleon, yes, but the Lewis brothers ensured the skeleton of the sound was unbreakable. The European connection. Around this time, reggae began penetrating Europe's counterculture. France, Germany, the UK, all were discovering in reggae a voice that mirrored their own class struggles, anti-colonial movements, and youth rebellion. Inner Circle's early records began surfacing at underground shows, pirate radio stations, and university listening parties. But it was Germany, in particular, that responded with intensity. Record buyers in Berlin and Hamburg gravitated toward Inner Circle's blend of seriousness and soul. Jacob's voice translated across languages. Even if you didn't understand patois, you understood the feeling, the yearning, the defiance, the joy. A bond was forming, and it would prove prophetic. Creative tension and breakthrough. Creative genius is rarely calm, and Inner Circle studio sessions were often intense. Jacob, always spiritually attuned, sometimes clashed with the band over song direction, especially if he felt a track lack message. Roger, ever the perfectionist, sometimes pushed takes until exhaustion, but that tension, it created magic. Their 1976-77 sessions yielded some of the richest work of their entire catalog. The songs became deeper, darker, more ambitious. Tracks like I'm a Rastaman, Discipline Child, and All Night Till Daylight reflected a band at their creative peak, refusing to chase trends and instead creating canon. Reggae historians today point to this window from 1975 to 1979 as Inner Circle's artistic golden age. They were unapologetically Jamaican, fiercely Pan-African, and deeply spiritual. The fire was burning bright, too bright perhaps. Warning signs and pressure. As the 1970s drew to a close, reggae was no longer underground. Major labels were circling. International markets were demanding more palatable versions. Jamaican producers were splitting over contracts, and the island itself was spiraling politically, economically, socially. Kingston in 1979 was not the Kingston of 1969. The sound system culture was still vibrant, but now laced with guns and fear. Political violence had reached a fever pitch. Artists had to watch what they said and where they said it. Inner Circle, always bold, never diluted their message. But with fame came risk. Jacob Miller, now one of the most recognizable faces in Jamaica, began receiving more than just fan love. There were pressures from politicians, promoters, and power brokers who wanted to shape the narrative. He resisted fiercely, but even he couldn't see what was coming. A legend at the precipice. By the end of 1979, Inner Circle had a catalog that could shake a country. Their reach was growing, their band was tighter than ever, and Jacob, always laughing, always glowing, seemed untouchable. They had recorded dozens of tracks, many never formally released, others pressed in small batches that are now priceless rarities. They were preparing for something big: international tours, wider distribution, possibly even crossover collaborations. The band was beginning to glimpse what superstardom might look like, not just in reggae, but on the world stage. But on March 23rd, 1980, everything would change. The fire they built would be tested in ways none of them could imagine. Chapter 5. The Smile of the Rebel, Jacob's anthemic soul. It was the smile, that colossal, uncontainable grin, wide as sunrise, framed by thick dreadlocks, crowned by a pair of eyes that sparkled with both joy and mischief. For all the vocal genius and spiritual defiance, for all the anthems and sermons wrapped in rhythm, it was Jacob Miller's smile that came to define a generation. To love reggae in the late 1970s was to know that smile. To see Jacob perform was to feel like you were in on a divine secret, as if Jah himself had picked this barefoot singer from the hills of Kingston and said, "Go shake the world with laughter and truth." But behind that iconic expression lived a soul that bore the weight of revolution, tragedy, and prophecy. And in the space of a few short years, Jacob Miller would become both the heartbeat and heartbreak of Inner Circle and of reggae itself. The voice that touched Zion. When Jacob sang, something happened. Something beyond technical skill or stagecraft. His voice was rich, smoky, and seasoned far beyond his years. It carried pain and promise in equal measure. Whether crooning about Rasta truths or mocking Babylon's hypocrisy, Jacob's vocals were never detached. They lived the lyrics. In songs like Healing of the Nation, he embodied a priest. In Tired Filic Weed, in a bush, he was a street philosopher, giggling as he exposed systemic absurdity. In Tenement Yard, he stood shoulder to shoulder with every youth in the ghetto, calling out watchy-watchy neighbors and the suffocating scrutiny of poverty. There was no persona. There was only Jacob. And through him, Inner Circle didn't just perform music. They channeled movement. The Jester Prophet. Jacob wasn't serious in the way Marley was. He didn't lecture. He didn't sermonize with fire and brimstone. Instead, he disarmed Babylon with wit. He was a jester prophet, like a court fool who used jokes to reveal hard truths. He'd mock the police, tease the big men, and laugh at the very systems designed to crush his people. And yet, he was deadly serious when it mattered. His antics on stage were legendary. He'd skip across the stage barefoot, grin mid-verse, break the fourth wall, and pull audience members into the performance. He turned concerts into communal experiences where the barrier between artist and listener dissolved. People didn't just watch Jacob, they saw themselves in him. His chubby frame defied the conventional image of a pop star. His unfiltered language defied media polish. His joy defied a world bent on breaking him. And yet, with all that rebellion, he never stopped smiling. Because for Jacob, smiling was resistance. The message in the music. By 1979, Inner Circle, now solidly anchored around Jacob's magnetic presence, had built a catalog that was both expansive and intentional. Tracks like We A Rockers and Forward Ja Ja Children weren't just danceable. They were cultural blueprints. They pointed to Africa, condemned colonial legacies, and urged Jamaican youth to recognize their worth beyond what Babylon dictated. They also touched on personal freedom, the right to smoke ganja, to chant down corruption, to live freely without being criminalized for identity. Jacob's insistence on authenticity made the music resonate across barriers. He wasn't just speaking to Jamaicans. He was speaking to the poor in London, the students in Accra, the freedom fighters in Soweto. Through his voice, reggae became transnational. The album that almost was. By early 1980, Inner Circle had begun assembling material for what would have been their international breakout record, a project meant to launch them fully onto the global stage, alongside Marley, Cliff, and Toots. The sound was tighter than ever. Jacob was in rare form, vocally, spiritually, emotionally. The band had matured, and their compositions blended roots, lovers rock, and crossover appeal without compromise. Industry buzz was building, promoters were circling, Europe was waiting, and so was tragedy. March 23rd, 1980, the day the laughter stopped. Jacob Miller died in a car crash on Hope Road in Kingston. He was 27 years old. Just months before, he had performed at Smile Jamaica, the now-famous concert Bob Marley played 2 days after an assassination attempt. Jacob had stolen the show, commanding the stage with humor, wisdom, and raw vocal brilliance. He was on top of the world, and then, in an instant, gone. The crash was brutal. Reports varied. Some blamed speeding. Others said Jacob had recently complained about fatigue. The car struck a utility pole. Jacob died on impact. It was sudden, shocking, and completely senseless. A nation mourned. The reggae community went silent. An Inner Circle, shattered and leaderless, was plunged into a darkness they never expected. A cultural funeral. Jacob Miller's funeral was no ordinary ceremony. It was a national event, a Rasta ritual, and a public reckoning. Thousands gathered. The streets of Kingston flooded with mourners, dreadlocks, children, elders, industry giants, and silent youth who had never felt represented by anyone else but Jacob. The service became a tribute to truth in sound. Nyabingi drums echoed through the hills. Musicians wept openly, and Roger and Ian Lewis stood among them, grief-stricken, unsure what the future held. One headline in the Gleaner read, "Jamaica has lost its laughing lion." And that was it. The voice, the smile, the rebel, gone. The void. Inner Circle didn't just lose their front man. They lost their soul. Jacob had been more than a singer. He was their compass, their bridge to the streets, their spiritual anchor. Without him, they were adrift. Plans for the album were shelved. Touring stopped. The studio fell silent. Some suggested finding a new singer, pushing forward. But how do you replace Jacob Miller? You don't. So for a while, Inner Circle disappeared. The legacy of a rebel soul. Even in death, Jacob Miller's influence didn't fade. If anything, it expanded. His songs remained on heavy rotation. His image, dreadlocked, joyful, and defiant, was immortalized on murals, album covers, and Rasta altars. Artists from across the Caribbean, Africa, and the diaspora cited him as inspiration. He had proven that truth could be joyful, that rebellion didn't require rage, that spiritual defiance could wear a smile. Jacob's legacy wasn't in how he died, it was in how he lived. Open, unfiltered, unafraid, an Inner Circle would carry that spirit eventually, though it would take years, into a new era that no one could have predicted. Chapter 6, Shockwaves, the tragic death of Jacob Miller. The streets of Kingston had gone strangely quiet. March 23rd, 1980. Word traveled fast, first through murmurs in sound system yards, then via scratchy car radios, and finally across the front pages of the Gleaner and the Star. Jacob Miller dies in crash. Reggae world mourns. The dread with the smile silenced. It didn't feel real. Not to the fans, not to the musicians, and certainly not to Inner Circle. The death of Jacob Miller sent a shockwave through Jamaica's cultural heart. His voice had embodied a people's joy and rebellion, and now that voice was gone, silenced by a telephone pole on Hope Road. He was 27 years old. Not since the passing of Don Drummond or Peter Tosh would the reggae world feel such a devastating loss. But Jacob's death was different, not just because of how sudden it was, but because of what it interrupted. He was at his peak. Inner Circle was poised to explode globally, and in a country already reeling from political bloodshed and economic unrest, Jacob's passing felt like a spiritual collapse. The dread is gone. Roger and Ian Lewis, co-founders of Inner Circle and Jacob's closest musical companions, were crushed. There was no plan for this, no blueprint for carrying on without the man who had transformed the band into a movement. The Lewis brothers rarely spoke publicly in the days following the crash. When they did, it was brief and solemn. Jacob was more than our brother. He was the voice of a generation. We're not sure what comes next. The band retreated, canceled shows, shelved recordings. The album they had been working on, a project intended to cement their international breakout, was put on indefinite hold. What remained was a hole, gaping and unfillable. A city in mourning. Jacob's funeral, held in Kingston days after his death, became one of the most emotional cultural gatherings in Jamaica's post-independence history. Thousands of fans walked barefoot in silent procession through Halfway Tree and into the hills where his body would be laid to rest. There were tears, hymns, chanting, and waves of drumming that echoed across the island. Among the mourners were Bunny Wailer, who wept quietly behind dark shades, Toots Hibbert, who called Jacob a brother in fire and harmony, Dennis Brown, Gregory Isaacs, and scores of other legends, many of whom performed tributes in the days that followed. The Rasta community honored Jacob not just as an artist, but as a cultural prophet. He had never claimed sainthood, but in his laughter, resistance, and boundless presence, he had embodied something divine. Murals popped up across Kingston, on zinc fences, concrete walls, and buses. His lyrics were spray-painted next to clenched fists and lion heads. School children in Trench Town and Spanish Town whispered his name like myth. A reggae timeline interrupted. Jacob's death was not just personal, it was historic. Reggae music was in a delicate moment. Bob Marley was battling cancer. Peter Tosh had already left the Wailers. The genre, once underground, was teetering on the edge of global commercialization. Jacob was supposed to be part of the next wave, raw, spiritual, and unmistakably Jamaican. His absence left more than grief. It left uncertainty. Would Inner Circle continue? Would reggae shift toward pop dilution without its rebels? Would the voice of the ghettos still be heard? Inner Circle disbands, quietly. There was no official press release, no final performance, no farewell statement. Inner Circle simply went quiet. The Lewis brothers, grieving and disoriented, stopped touring. Studio sessions dried up. Keyboardists, drummers, and backup vocalists returned to other projects. The circle, once so vibrant and expansive, closed inward. In interviews years later, Roger Lewis would admit, "We couldn't imagine doing it without him. For a long time, we didn't even try." Ian Lewis echoed the sentiment. "Jacob wasn't just our lead singer, he was the soul. We needed time to remember who we were." The unreleased songs. In the months before Jacob's death, Inner Circle had been working on what would have been their most polished and international-ready album to date. Though never formally titled, the project included a series of tracks that blended Jacob's raw vocal power with a production style leaning toward crossover reggae funk. Several of these tracks would later resurface in compilations and bootlegs. Have Some Mercy, Standing Firm, All Night Till Daylight. But many others remain unreleased, trapped in analog reels stored in Kingston vaults or lost to time. The unreleased songs became ghosts, whispering what might have been. Fans clung to the few studio versions available, treating them like sacred texts. The Jacob Miller effect lives on. In the absence of new music, Jacob's existing discography grew in power. Songs like Tenement Yard became folk anthems, sung at protests, played at funerals, blasted at dancehall sessions long after midnight. His voice was sampled by hip-hop artists, covered by reggae revivalists, and looped in remixes across continents. But more than his music, it was Jacob's energy that endured. His image, barefoot, smiling, arms outstretched, became a symbol of resistance with joy. In a world that often demanded anger as the only valid form of rebellion, Jacob had dared to be playful. He had made truth palatable, even when it stung. What now? By 1981, Inner Circle was a memory, a legacy, a band with a past but no present. Jamaica had shifted. Bob Marley died in May that year. Peter Tosh was on a more militant path. The Roots era was closing, giving way to dancehall. Faster, more aggressive, less spiritual. But even as the genre morphed, Jacob's name remained unshaken. New fans were born into his voice. Old fans refused to let him fade. And somewhere in Miami, the Lewis brothers began to rebuild. Quietly, slowly, respectfully. It would take years. But from the ashes of loss, Inner Circle would one day rise again. This time with a different sound, a broader audience, and a song that would become one of the most recognizable reggae anthems in the world. But first, they had to survive the silence. Chapter 7, Retaliation, Survival, Exile, and Reinvention. In the aftermath of Jacob Miller's death, Inner Circle did not die. It scattered, emotionally, creatively, geographically. For a band that had once burned with unity, purpose, and Rastafari fire, the silence following Jacob's funeral was deafening. But silence, as Jamaica knows too well, is never the end. It is the inhale before the storm. This chapter in Inner Circle's journey would not be written with the voice of a prophet, but with the grinding will of survivors. No longer guided by the jubilant spirit of Jacob, the Lewis brothers, Ian and Roger, found themselves at a crossroads, fade into legacy, or redefine their destiny. They chose the harder path, and that path began not in Kingston, but thousands of miles away, in Miami, Florida. Exodus, leaving Kingston behind. Kingston in the early 1980s was shifting, politically unstable, economically depressed, and creatively fragmented. The deaths of Marley, 1981, and Miller, 1980, were more than losses. They marked the end of the Roots reggae era. A new sound, dancehall, was rising from the ashes, brash, digital, aggressive. For Inner Circle, the Kingston that had birthed them was no longer home. Without Jacob, the city felt haunted. The political tensions, the studio doors that had once welcomed them, now echoed with emptiness. The Lewis brothers made a difficult decision. We had to leave. In 1982, they relocated to Miami, seeking a fresh beginning in a new land, one that had its own Caribbean diaspora, emerging music scene, and cultural hunger. It wasn't Kingston, but it was possibility. Reinvention begins in silence. Miami was not glamorous. At least, not at first. The brothers arrived with no record deal, no chart-topping hits, and no frontman. Their name meant little outside reggae circles. They worked odd jobs, played small gigs, and built connections slowly. The American market was not yet ready to embrace reggae without Marley, but Ian and Roger didn't rush. They studied the new soundscape, the rise of hip-hop, the crossover appeal of Latin beats, the slick production values of 80s pop, They saw opportunity not in imitation, but in evolution. They also began rebuilding Inner Circle, piece by piece. Keyboardists, drummers, session players, and most importantly, a new voice. The search for a sound. Inner Circle didn't want to replace Jacob. They knew no one could. Instead, they sought to reframe the band. Rather than chasing the roots reggae space they once dominated, the Lewis brothers began crafting a fusion sound. Reggae at its core, but layered with pop hooks, rock energy, and funk bass lines. It was controversial. Some reggae purists accused them of selling out, but the brothers weren't apologizing. If reggae is to live, Roger once said, it must grow. We can't be stuck in time. Jacob taught us to experiment, to mix joy and rebellion. That's what we're still doing. They began recording again, cautiously at first. Tracks like Sweat and Rock With You hinted at a more global appeal, but they needed that one track, the bridge between the past and the future, the retaliation, the rebirth. Enter Bad Boys. In 1987, Inner Circle recorded a track that would change everything. Bad Boys, Bad Boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? The song was originally written as a commentary on police harassment and systemic profiling, a carryover from their Roots-era consciousness. But its infectious hook, coupled with a rock-tinged reggae groove, made it radio gold. No one, not even Inner Circle, could have predicted what came next. Bad Boys was picked up in the early 1990s as the theme song for Fox's hit TV show Cops, a gritty voyeuristic look at American policing that aired across millions of homes weekly. Almost overnight, Bad Boys became a cultural phenomenon. Inner Circle was everywhere, on talk shows, in commercials, playing college campuses, and massive European festivals. A song born from Caribbean resistance was now playing at football games, on movie soundtracks, and in nightclubs across the world. The irony and the impact. To some, it was confusing. It was a song originally written from the lens of the oppressed, now associated with the enforcers of state power. Bad Boys had been rebranded by the mainstream, not as protest, but as theme music for authority. But Inner Circle never disowned the track, Roger Lewis clarified in interviews. People misunderstood the song, but we didn't. We knew what it meant, and every time it played, it was still a reminder of who gets chased and why. In a twist only reggae could deliver, Bad Boys became both a global hit and a Trojan horse, slipping Rasta consciousness into the pop consciousness without anyone noticing, and it worked. From exile to explosive fame. By the early 1990s, Inner Circle had become a global reggae pop powerhouse. They weren't just back, they were bigger than ever. The lineup had evolved. Calton Coffee took on lead vocals for the Bad Boys era, bringing a new texture to the sound. The live shows became elaborate productions. Lights, dancers, full band arrangements. The band toured nonstop. Europe, South America, Japan, the US. Their album Bad Boys 1993 and follow-up Reggae Dancer 1994 solidified their place not just as reggae artists, but as global crossover icons. Inner Circle had done the impossible. They survived the death of Jacob Miller, weathered the collapse of Roots Reggae, and reinvented themselves in exile without compromising their DNA. Still Circle, still Inner. Even as they gained international fame, the Lewis brothers never let go of the foundation. They remained active in cultural conversations about Jamaica, Rasta identity, and music's role in social change. They started their own studio, Circle House Studios in Miami, where they mentored younger artists, collaborated with stars, and kept the flame burning for the next generation. They weren't just musicians. They had become elders, and their retaliation wasn't rage. It was resilience. Chapter 8. Alliances, collaborations, Circle House, and global impact. By the mid-1990s, Inner Circle wasn't just a band. They were a movement factory, and their home base was a newly constructed Sonic Temple in North Miami called Circle House Studios. What began as a personal sanctuary, a private space for healing, rebuilding, and music making, quickly transformed into one of the most influential reggae and pop culture hubs in the Western Hemisphere. It was a place where past met present, where legacy met innovation, and where legends and newcomers collided under one roof. Inner Circle had returned to the world stage, but they weren't interested in just dominating the charts anymore. They wanted to build bridges. The birth of Circle House Studios. Launched in the early 1990s by the Lewis brothers, Circle House Studios wasn't just a recording studio, it was a philosophy. Located in a modest neighborhood in Miami, the studio was intentionally designed to feel open, relaxed, and familial. A place where producers, engineers, DJs, vocalists, and instrumentalists could collaborate without pressure. No polished glass booths or major label pretenses. Just sound and spirit. The idea was simple. Let the music grow organically and give young talent the room to find their voice. And it worked spectacularly. Circle House Studios would go on to host some of the biggest names in modern music, crossing genres from reggae and dancehall to hip-hop R&B and Latin pop. The Collaborators. Inner Circle's openness to collaboration became one of their defining powers in this era. Instead of walling themselves off in genre loyalty or veteran elitism, they embraced the new wave and invited it in. The list of artists who recorded at Circle House or worked with Inner Circle is staggering. Sean Paul, DJ Khaled, Akon, Flo Rida, Pitbull, Rick Ross, Trina, Backstreet Boys, Lauryn Hill. But it wasn't just about getting credits or streaming numbers. The Lewis brothers were on a cultural mission, one that echoed Jacob Miller's ethos, make good music and uplift the people who create it. Inner Circle began to see themselves not just as performers, but as cultural producers, mentors, guides, uncles of the rhythm. Young artists looked up to them, not just for their hits, but for their philosophy of longevity. Bridging generations and genres. While Inner Circle's core sound remained reggae, their reach became genreless. Tracks like Summer Jammin', Games People Play, and Sweat, A La 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 Long, became mainstays of international pop and dance playlists. Yet beneath the catchy melodies was always a message. Subtle nods to freedom, unity, and identity. They used their music and studio to create safe spaces where genres could blend. Hip-hop artists rapped over one-drop rhythms. Latin pop stars sang over dancehall best lines. EDM producers sampled Jacob Miller's archive vocals. This melting pot wasn't accidental. It was Caribbean cultural strategy. Because at its core, Inner Circle was pan-Caribbean. Their worldview stretched from Kingston to Port of Spain, from Santo Domingo to Miami, from Africa to the diaspora, and Circle House became the physical embodiment of that global reach. The Bad Boys aftershock. Even as Inner Circle explored new creative frontiers, the shadow of Bad Boys followed them. The song, now iconic, had taken on a life of its own. With the rise of Cops, and eventually, the Will Smith-Martin Lawrence film franchise Bad Boys, the track became an unofficial anthem of law enforcement pop culture. Despite its subversive roots, this led to tension, both philosophical and fan-based. Critics accused the band of selling out. Others questioned whether the song's original message had been buried under blue lights and arrest montages. But Inner Circle remained unapologetic. "We know what the song meant when we wrote it," Roger stated in an interview. "And if it's still playing 30 years later, we must have done something right." And they had. Because despite its mainstream use, Bad Boys remained a reggae Trojan horse, smuggling a Jamaican sound into every American living room, week after week, year after year. Reggae ambassadors. As the years progressed, Inner Circle took on the role of global reggae ambassadors. They performed at Reggae Sumfest, Jamaica, Rotterdam Sunsplash, Spain. Chimsey Reggae Summer, Germany. Rebel Salute, Jamaica. Montreux Jazz Festival, Switzerland. In each of these spaces, they carried not just their own legacy, but the memory of Jacob Miller, the spirit of 70s Kingston, and the fire of Jamaican musical resilience. They spoke openly about the commercialization of reggae, the erasure of Caribbean pioneers in global music narratives, the need to protect Caribbean intellectual property, the importance of passing the torch to younger artists. Inner Circle became custodians of culture, not just performers. Youth and the next wave. Perhaps the most powerful aspect of Inner Circle's modern legacy is their commitment to youth. Through Circle House and independent mentorship programs, they offered free studio time to underprivileged youth, music business workshops for Caribbean students, collaborations with high school musicians and aspiring sound engineers, scholarships to Jamaican diaspora youth pursuing music education. They understood that legacy wasn't just measured in albums sold, but in doors opened. As Roger Lewis said, "We had Jacob, we had Bob, now these kids have us. That's the circle, that's the point." The global impact. By the late 2010s and into the 2020s, Inner Circle had defied every imaginable category. They were a roots band without its original prophet. They were a pop band rooted in Rastafari. They were elders who still filled arenas. They were traditionalists who embraced technology and digital innovation. And more than anything, they were survivors, not just of personal loss, but of an industry that too often discards Black pioneers after the hype fades. They had stayed. They had adapted. They had built. They had given back. The circle was not only unbroken, it had expanded. Chapter 9. Collapse begins. Fame, fractures, and internal strain. By the dawn of the new millennium, Inner Circle stood tall, global legends with chart-topping hits, a thriving Miami-based studio, and an ever-expanding list of high-profile collaborators. From small dancehall clubs to packed international festivals, they were still in motion, still relevant, and still celebrated. But beneath the polished sound and smiling stage presence, something was shifting. Not a breakup, not a scandal, something subtler, more insidious. Fame had become friction, not the loud, explosive kind, but the slow, tightening sort that creeps in through exhaustion, conflicting visions, and the quiet weight of legacy. The circle wasn't broken, but it was under pressure. The cost of constant motion. Inner Circle had been moving for decades. Since the late 1960s, the Lewis brothers had been on a treadmill of performances, recordings, reinvention, and survival. The death of Jacob Miller had nearly destroyed them, but the success of Bad Boys and Sweat gave them a second win that lasted well into the 2000s. Yet that momentum came at a price. They toured endlessly. They recorded constantly. They mentored tirelessly. It was a noble grind, but a grind nonetheless. By 2005, burnout was showing. Vocalist Calton Coffey, the voice behind many of their 90s hits, began to step back due to health issues. Circle House Studios, while thriving, began consuming more of Ian and Roger's time than the band itself. Younger members rotated in and out, sometimes bringing new energy, sometimes clashing with the core philosophy. The music was still tight, the performances still powerful, but the unity, it was thinning. Calton Coffey's departure. The departure of Calton Coffey marked a key moment in Inner Circle's evolving dynamic. His soulful, high-energy voice had given global hits like Sweat, A La 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 Long, and Games People Play their signature tone. He had been more than a vocalist. He was the band's stage heartbeat in the post-Jacob era. But behind the scenes, Coffey was dealing with serious health complications, including issues with his lungs and kidneys. The touring lifestyle became unsustainable. He officially stepped away from the band in the mid-2000s. There was no falling out, no headlines, just silence, and a noticeable absence. For fans, Coffey's voice was inseparable from Inner Circle's 90s legacy. For the band, his departure was another emotional echo, a reminder of Jacob, of loss, of how fragile momentum can be. They found a new vocalist, yes, but the rhythm of the group shifted, and with it, so did the energy. Creative tension. As Inner Circle moved further into the 2010s, new challenges emerged, not from outside, but from within. The Lewis brothers were now seasoned elders, protective of the band's legacy. They had navigated death, exile, reinvention, and crossover fame, and they had done it their way. But some newer members, younger musicians, collaborators, and even touring vocalists had different ideas. They wanted to explore newer genres more aggressively, EDM, trap-infused reggae, commercial dancehall. There were debates in studio sessions. Should they drop a full dancehall album? Should they remix old hits for TikTok and Instagram culture? Should they partner with major labels again or stay fully independent? These weren't just business decisions. They were existential. What did Inner Circle mean in 2020? Were they a heritage act, a reggae brand, a musical mentorship collective? No one said it out loud, but the question hung in the air. Is this still the same band we built in Kingston? Circle House Overload. As the touring band navigated its identity, Circle House Studios became its own empire, one that required constant attention, management, and protection. The Lewis brothers, especially Roger, found themselves pulled between running a world-class recording studio, protecting reggae's cultural integrity, managing band logistics, touring globally, mentoring younger Caribbean artists. It was too much. And while the music never stopped, the brotherhood began to stretch thin. Ian focused more on sound production and studio management. Roger leaned into performance and public presence. They were still aligned, but moving in parallel, not always together. Inner Circle was no longer a tight five-piece family. It had become an institution, powerful, respected, but increasingly compartmentalized. The challenge of relevance. One of the hardest battles for any legacy band is not survival, it's relevance. Inner Circle's catalog remained legendary. Their live shows still drew thousands, but the music industry had changed. Attention spans shrank. Streaming algorithms replaced DJs. Viral hits meant more than musical depth. Inner Circle never chased trends, but they did adapt. They released remixes, collaborated with modern producers, re-released classic hits with contemporary vocalists. But deep down, the pressure to stay current was exhausting. Younger audiences adored the Bad Boys hook, but few knew Jacob's name. Global fans danced to Sweat, but rarely understood the politics behind Peace Treaty. And industry execs saw Inner Circle more as a brand than a band. That disconnect hurt. Silently, persistently. Quiet conflicts. There were no fistfights, no lawsuits, no tabloid-worthy implosions. Inner Circle's fractures were quiet missed rehearsals, unreturned calls, disagreements over merch rights and streaming strategy, resentment over public credit, who gets mentioned in press, who gets booked, who gets left behind. Like many long-running collectives, the real danger wasn't explosive betrayal. It was erosion. Little by little, the weight of decades, of Jacob's ghost, of global expectation, of evolving technology, of endless compromise, began to strain the circle. And still, they pressed on. Because that's what survivors do. The show must go on. Despite everything, Inner Circle continued to tour, record, and mentor. Because Inner Circle is more than its lineup. It is a covenant, forged in Kingston, tested by fire, and rooted in legacy. They refused to let internal tension derail the mission. But behind the scenes, it was clear. Something would have to change. Something would have to give. Because you can only run at full speed for so long before the body, or the band, begins to bend. The circle wasn't broken, but the cracks were showing. Chapter 10, Turning Point, Reflection, Revival, and Reinvention. Every legendary band faces a reckoning, that moment where the applause fades, the lights dim, and all that remains is the truth. For Inner Circle, that reckoning came not with scandal or failure, but with silence, a pause, a question, a decision. What was left for a reggae band that had already survived the unthinkable? Who were they now, after fame, loss, reinvention, and friction? It was in that quiet moment, after the noise of decades, after the exhaustion of reinvention, that the Lewis brothers found their next evolution. They didn't break up. They didn't retire. Instead, Inner Circle turned inward, back to their roots, back to purpose, and asked a single question. What do we want the circle to mean now? The answer would reshape their legacy, not through a hit record or world tour, but through reflection and revival. Stepping back to move forward. In the early 2000s and 20s, the world changed. The pandemic silenced stages. Tours halted. Studios emptied. Festivals vanished overnight. For a band like Inner Circle, whose identity was tied to live energy, it was a cultural standstill. But in that standstill came clarity. Roger and Ian Lewis, now music elders in every sense of the word, used the global pause to reflect on Jacob, on their younger selves, on what reggae meant in an era of social media and virtual concerts, on whether Inner Circle was still relevant or just remembered. It wasn't an easy process. They revisited unreleased demos. They listened to bootlegs from the 70s. They played old Jacob Miller tapes. And slowly, they began to realize something powerful. Inner Circle didn't need to compete. They needed to curate. They were no longer just musicians. They were keepers of flame. Legacy as a living thing. The first part of Inner Circle's reinvention was philosophical. They redefined their mission not to chase streams or awards, but to preserve the roots, to mentor the future, to protect the culture. Roger Lewis began calling it legacy management. Instead of measuring success by chart performance, Inner Circle began focusing on archiving their history, remastering old tapes, digitizing rare sessions, building a searchable reggae archive, youth empowerment, hosting free Zoom workshops during lockdowns, offering songwriting clinics for Caribbean students, cultural storytelling, partnering with universities and museums to chronicle reggae's rise and Inner Circle's role in it. They were no longer chasing headlines. They were building foundation. Musical revival on their terms. But the music never stopped. In 2021, Inner Circle released Freedom Sound, a global compilation project that featured new voices from the Caribbean, Africa, and Latin America. Rather than centering themselves, they stood in the background, providing rhythm, wisdom, and authenticity. Songs like World Peace and No Justice, No Peace resonated with a world still healing from protests, pandemics, and unrest. They weren't trying to be 20 again. They were speaking as veterans, with scars, with soul, with clarity. The project earned critical praise, not for its commercialism, but for its relevance. It was mature reggae, honest, steady, rooted. They followed it with intimate concerts, acoustic sessions in cultural centers, virtual jam sessions from Circle House, collaborations with artists like Chronix, Protoje, and Kabaka Pyramid. The circle was turning, not loudly, not explosively, but with intent. Healing the fractures. With this philosophical pivot came a healing within the group. The internal tensions of the 2010s began to ease. Younger members found their lane. Veteran collaborators felt respected again. The Lewis brothers began trusting the process. They weren't trying to force relevance anymore. They were building something timeless. And something else began to happen. Jacob Miller's name returned to the center. They started releasing rare recordings, live albums from his last tours, remastered solo works, documentaries exploring his impact. Inner Circle wasn't just honoring Jacob. They were bringing him home. Roger called it the full circle within the circle. The fans return. As Inner Circle leaned deeper into legacy, something remarkable occurred. The fans followed. Not just older fans from the Bad Boys or Jacob Miller era, but new ones. Gen Z kids discovering roots reggae for the first time on TikTok. Diaspora youth hungry for cultural identity. Social justice movements looking for soundtracks to their struggle. Inner Circle's music, steady, defiant, joyful, offered an anchor. They weren't relics, they were elders. And in an age of constant noise, their sound was suddenly crucial again. A new purpose. By 2023, Inner Circle was no longer chasing the next hit. They were preserving the first truth. They launched a podcast exploring reggae's revolutionary history, a Circle House Fellowship for Caribbean female producers, a music education initiative in Jamaica focused on storytelling and sound systems. They also began work on their most ambitious project yet, the Inner Circle Legacy Archive, a digital and physical library preserving recordings, interviews, writings, and footage from every era of their journey. "If we don't tell our story," Ian said, "someone else will, and they'll get it wrong." The turning point. Inner Circle's turning point wasn't a concert. It wasn't a comeback album. It wasn't a viral moment. It was a decision to stop chasing the world and instead serve it, to protect the roots, to honor the fallen, to guide the next generation. They hadn't lost relevance. They had simply outgrown the chase. Now, they stood firmly, seasoned, soulful, and smiling, knowing the circle had never broken. It had simply been waiting for this moment. Chapter 11, Doubt, the Shadows of Legacy and Identity. Legacy is a heavy crown. For Inner Circle, the weight wasn't just in what they had built, but in the expectation that they continue to carry it. By 2024, the Lewis brothers, now both in their 70s, had achieved what few Caribbean artists ever could. They had survived the death of their iconic frontman, reinvented themselves into global pop culture, mentored generations through Circle House Studios, retained their independence, vision, and spiritual compass. But still, in quiet moments, doubt crept in. Not the kind of doubt that asks, "Can we keep going?" The kind that whispers, "Have we done enough? Have we told the story right? Will they remember what we meant or just what we sold?" In this chapter, we explore the shadow side of legacy, the reckoning that comes when the music fades into memory and the artists must face their reflection in silence. Aging in the echo chamber. For decades, Inner Circle had been surrounded by noise, applause, interviews, collaborations, tour schedules, studio sessions, award ceremonies. But as they leaned into cultural preservation over performance, the quiet became deafening. The Lewis brothers were no longer on stage every weekend. Their days were filled with archiving, advising, and curating the past, not creating the future. That transition, though intentional, brought a new type of identity crisis. Are we still Inner Circle if we're not performing? If no one hears the new music, does it still count? Was our crossover success a triumph or a dilution of the message? They weren't chasing fame, but in the absence of constant public validation, they had to wrestle with themselves. The ghost of Jacob. Jacob Miller had always been both a blessing and a burden. His energy had defined their rise. His death had nearly defined their fall. And now, in reflection, he returned in full force, not as memory, but as mirror. The band had tried to honor him through remastered releases, through documentary interviews, through tributes in concerts. But privately, the doubt lingered. Did we do right by Jacob? Would he have approved of Bad Boys? Did we evolve too far away from what we started as? Roger especially carried this question. Jacob had been his friend, his frontman, his co-conspirator in rhythm, and though the world celebrated Inner Circle's global success, Roger often wondered if they had unconsciously compromised too much in order to survive. The burden of the crossover. There's an unspoken curse that follows many artists who break through globally. The thing that makes you famous is rarely the thing you care about most. For Inner Circle, that thing was Bad Boys. A song written from the heart of Caribbean resistance had become Copaganda, unintentionally aligning the band's image with policing, authority, and mass media spectacle. To this day, some younger fans only know Inner Circle as the band from Cops. And that hurt, not because of ego, but because of misunderstanding. In interviews, Roger and Ian tried to reframe the narrative. Bad Boys was always about the oppressed. It just got flipped by the system. But re-educating the public after decades of branding is no easy task. They had used the global platform to elevate reggae. Yes, but had the world heard what they meant or just what they marketed? Inner Circle versus reggae institutions. While Inner Circle had earned the respect of fans, artists, and collaborators, they often felt undervalued by institutional reggae culture. Major documentaries about reggae history, including high-profile ones backed by U.S. platforms, sometimes left them out entirely or mentioned them in passing. Award shows overlooked them. Industry panels rarely invited them to speak. Curators, mostly foreign, categorized them as commercial reggae, subtly implying they had lost their roots. Roger bristled at this. "We were there from the beginning. Jacob was a prophet. We toured Africa when no one else did. We built studios. We trained youth. Don't tell me we aren't real reggae." There was no bitterness in his tone, only frustration. The truth is, Inner Circle never fit neatly into the Marley Wailer mold. They were different, funkier, looser, more experimental. That uniqueness had brought them global success, but it had also made them harder to archive. Family mortality and the next generation. As the brothers aged, the question of succession emerged. Who would carry the circle forward? Their children were involved, some musically, others in studio management. But the spirit of Inner Circle wasn't in business plans. It was in sweat, in stage lights, in the risk of rebellion. Could that be inherited? Would younger generations respect the layers of what Inner Circle represented? And more personally, when we go, will they remember what we stood for? The fear wasn't irrelevant. It was misinterpretation. They had fought so hard to control their story, but legacy, like music, is ultimately owned by the audience. And that truth created doubt. The circle within. In their quietest moments, the Lewis brothers returned to a mantra: the circle never ends. It wasn't just branding, it was belief. Even in doubt, even in shadow, even when misunderstood, Inner Circle meant something, and that meaning, once planted, would grow in places they'd never see. They had put their souls into sound, into communities, into young artists who now carried reggae into digital landscapes. And though doubt lingered, as it does for all true artists, it was always met with one defiant truth. We survived, we served, we gave. And that, in the end, was enough. Chapter 12, Flashback, Kingston Roots, before the circle formed, before the tours, before Jacob, before Bad Boys and Circle House, and global fame. There was Kingston, raw, vibrant, dangerous, beautiful, a city on the edge of revolution, a birthplace of rhythms that would one day change the world. And in the middle of it all, two brothers, Ian and Roger Lewis, navigating crowded streets, record shops, and political unrest, unknowingly absorbing the spirit of a movement. To understand Inner Circle is to rewind before the music. Back to the neighborhoods, the schoolyards, the zinc roof houses that clanged in hurricanes, the dance halls that pulsed with forbidden drums, the radio stations that mixed American soul with Caribbean fire. This was not just childhood, this was formation. Kingston in the 1960s, a city on the edge. The Jamaica that raised the Lewis brothers was newly independent, a nation still searching for its own voice after shedding the British flag in 1962. And Kingston, the capital, was a paradox, bursting with talent but crippled by inequality, politically fractured but culturally unified in rhythm, poor in currency but rich in creative fire. The city's pulse was not found in its parliament buildings, but in the sound systems. Mobile dance halls built on speaker boxes, spinning American R&B, ska, and eventually a new slower groove called rocksteady. From Arnett Gardens to Trenchtown, from Halfway Tree to Jungle, these neighborhoods raised a generation of musicians. Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, Jimmy Cliff, they were all walking these same streets as Ian and Roger, breathing the same smog-filled air, dodging the same gang politics. Ian and Roger, sons of the Pulse. Born in Kingston to a modest family, Roger, bass, and Ian, guitar, vocals, were not born into music, but they were born into rhythm. Roger was the older brother, confident, headstrong, always leading. Ian was more introspective, quietly absorbing everything around him, fascinated by sound patterns and arrangements. Their earliest exposure to music wasn't formal. It was street music, church choirs, tin pan drumming, crackling radios playing Sam Cooke, Otis Redding, and Marvin Gaye. They'd build makeshift instruments out of tins and wood, sneak into dance halls too young to be noticed, spend hours watching older musicians rehearse, mimicking the finger patterns, the bass slaps, the vocal vibrato. This wasn't about dreams of fame. This was about survival. In a Kingston battered by colonial hangover, music wasn't a luxury. It was a lifeline. The influence of American soul and Jamaican struggle. The Lewis brothers, like most Kingston youth of their era, lived in a sonic double world. On one side, the booming influence of American soul and funk, Curtis Mayfield, James Brown, Aretha Franklin. On the other, the emerging power of Jamaican grassroots sound, ska, rocksteady, and eventually reggae. The American records came in through sailors, military radio, and hustlers smuggling vinyl in from Miami. These grooves shaped the musical backbone of Kingston's youth. Bass-driven, emotionally charged, tightly arranged. But the lyrics, the stories, those had to be local. The Lewis brothers felt that tension and used it. Their earliest jam sessions blended Curtis Mayfield guitar licks with the slower, rootsier timing of rocksteady. They played cover songs, not to imitate, but to translate. What James Brown shouted, they would chant in patois. What Motown romanticized, they grounded in ghetto realism. They were beginning to form something new, something not American, not entirely Jamaican, something in between, something that would soon become Inner Circle. Schools, rehearsals, and zinc fence studios. The brothers' earliest bands were school-born, quick-form projects for talent shows and holiday concerts. They played anywhere that would have them. Community centers, church events, pool halls. By the mid-1960s, they were moving beyond teenage curiosity into full-blown obsession. They scouted other musicians, classmates who could hold harmonies, yardmen who could bang rhythms on metal with uncanny timing, girls with jazz-like phrasing who sang like angels in gospel circles. By 1968, Roger and Ian were gigging regularly. They weren't yet Inner Circle. That name wouldn't come until later, but the vision was forming. They weren't just interested in playing what they heard. They wanted to create something new. They hung around the emerging Kingston studios. Studio One, Treasure Isle, Dynamic Sounds, offering to carry gear, sit in on sessions, sweep floors, tune guitars, just to be close to the fire. And at night, they'd rehearse for hours. No managers, no contracts, just faith. Rasta vibes and street politics. As their musicianship matured, so did their worldview. Jamaica was becoming more politically polarized, especially in Kingston, where gang violence often masqueraded as party loyalty. The Lewis brothers, while not political militants, saw the devastation up close. They also witnessed the rise of Rastafari consciousness, not just as a religion, but as a resistance philosophy. The streets were filled with chants of Babylon must fall, and images of Haile Selassie began replacing Queen Elizabeth in the hearts of young men. This wasn't an academic idea. It was revolution with rhythm. The brothers weren't devout Rastas at the time, but they were Rasta-aligned in soul. They understood the power of message, and they knew that their music, if it was going to mean anything, had to speak truth. The circle begins to form. By the end of the 1960s, with the addition of key players like keyboardist Michael Ebo Cooper and others, the core sound was developing. The band began experimenting with jazz chords, Afrobeat polyrhythms, and dub echo effects. Then came the name Inner Circle, a nod to trust, secrecy, spiritual unity. It represented a sacred bond between the musicians, and between them and the people. This wasn't a pop act. This was a ritual, a movement, and while the world wouldn't fully hear them until the 1970s, the circle was already pulsing. A foundation etched in stone. What emerged in Kingston during these early years wasn't just the backstory of a band. It was the origin myth of a cultural institution, a story built on poverty and percussion, resistance and rhythm, family and faith. Everything Inner Circle would become, every album, every anthem, every survival, was rooted in these early Kingston years, in the grime and grace of a post-colonial city still learning how to dream. And that dream, once whispered in backyards and echo chambers, would soon roar across the globe. Chapter 13, Spiral, Music Industry Pressure, and the Digital Disruption. By the time Inner Circle entered the second decade of the 2000s, the music industry had transformed beyond recognition. Vinyl had become vintage. CDs were dead. Streaming ruled. And for a band that had once ruled dance halls and stadium stages, the digital shift posed an invisible but relentless threat. This wasn't a crash. It was a spiral, slow, nuanced, often masked by the illusion of access and exposure. But behind the metrics and mobile apps was a truth the Lewis brothers couldn't ignore. The game had changed, and not in their favor. The fall of the gatekeepers and the rise of the algorithm. For decades, reggae, like all genres, had relied on key systems to thrive. Radio DJs breaking new tracks, record shops handpicking vinyl and creating cult classics, stage shows generating buzz for rising talent. Distributors, linking Kingston to London, New York, and Tokyo. But by the late 2000s and 10s, those systems were either gone or powerless. Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok. Playlists replaced DJs. Followers replaced fan bases. Trends replaced talent. Inner Circle, once one of the most recognized Caribbean names in the world, found themselves algorithmically invisible. Their classic catalog, from Tenement Yard to Games People Play, was streamed in the background, embedded in nostalgia playlists curated by faceless corporate entities. But their new work, ignored, buried, lost in the feed. A band out of time. The paradox was painful. They had a state-of-the-art studio, a deep catalog of unreleased recordings, partnerships with emerging global artists, industry respect across genres. And yet, they struggled to get playlisted, struggled to trend, struggled to be heard. It wasn't a lack of creativity. It was misalignment with the moment. The youth, raised on snippets, loops, and shock value content, didn't know what to do with Inner Circle's soulful grooves and revolutionary undertones. They were too melodic for trap, too seasoned for TikTok, too old school for algorithmic rotation. And the industry, increasingly driven by data over depth, offered no solutions. Circle House caught in a storm. Even Circle House Studios, their pride and joy, felt the spiral. Younger artists still book sessions, many drawn to the studio's legacy and vibe. But budgets were shrinking. Labels offered less. artists brought laptop beats and expected studio quality masters for a fraction of the old costs. The Lewis brothers watched as a new generation of producers, brilliant, bold, but often detached from musical history, churned out hits using presets and AI mastering plugins. It wasn't jealousy, it was displacement. Inner Circle, once trendsetters, were now being asked to modernize their sound, shorten their songs, collaborate with viral voices, or be left behind. They tried, respectfully, to adapt. They created remix projects, sample packs, re-released classics with updated features, but the soul wasn't always there. And worse, the demand wasn't either. Financial strain and creative dissonance. While Inner Circle was far from broke, the digital shift created economic tension. Streaming royalties were a fraction of what physical sales had once brought in. Licensing was inconsistent, with rights often mismanaged or exploited by third parties. YouTube content was constantly flagged, disputed, or monetized by platforms rather than the creators. Roger and Ian, lifelong independents, refused to sell the catalog, but they could feel the temptation creeping in. Some peers had taken major label buyouts. Others had sold publishing rights for lump sums. Some faded into obscurity, unable to keep up with the digital pace. The Lewis brothers debated their next move quietly, cautiously. Do we protect the legacy, or do we leverage it before it disappears? There was no easy answer, only more pressure, more spiraling. Questions without answers. As 2020 passed into 2021, then 2022, the existential questions became louder. What does a reggae band mean in the age of digital dancehall? Are we archivists, artists, or entrepreneurs now? Who are we making music for? Us or the algorithm? Will Jacob be remembered as more than a face on a mural? Is the circle still sacred, or has it become a commodity? Even the fans, loyal and loving, were evolving. They wanted more behind-the-scenes content, more real-time engagement, more reels, stories, and shorts. But the brothers came from a different world, a world where the mystique was part of the magic, where music wasn't explained, it was felt. Reggae's cultural drift. On a larger level, Inner Circle also watched as reggae itself became fragmented. The genre's Jamaican roots were being overtaken by Afrobeats, Latin Urbano, and dancehall hybrids. Global audiences no longer recognized the difference between reggae and reggaeton. Younger Caribbean artists were fusing genres, but often skipping over foundational history. Inner Circle didn't resent this evolution, but they feared that reggae's origin story was being rewritten without its authors. Their voice, once a torch, now flickered in the winds of digital culture. The spiral within. Through all this, the band kept working. They wrote, they collaborated, they performed, smaller shows, legacy festivals, cultural events. But the energy was different. They were no longer fighting to be heard. They were fighting to stay whole, spiritually, emotionally, culturally. The spiral wasn't about failure. It was about disconnection. And disconnection for a band built on Circle was the deepest threat of all. Chapter 14, Exposure, Global Recognition, and the Rediscovery of Jacob Miller. The spiral had left them bruised, but not broken. And in 2023, like some quiet cosmic response, a spark flickered from an unexpected source. A documentary clip, barely 2 minutes long, uploaded to YouTube by a European reggae archivist. It showed Jacob Miller, shirtless and barefoot, in a 1979 rehearsal, laughing between takes, launching into Tenement Yard with such unfiltered joy that the comment section exploded. Who is this guy? Why haven't I seen this before? His energy, it's unreal. It was like the world had just discovered Jacob Miller again, and this time, they weren't comparing him to Marley. They were seeing him for what he was, his own category. What followed was a cascade of recognition, a sudden wave of rediscovery that reached far beyond reggae's borders and reignited the fire beneath Inner Circle's legacy. Viral Resurrection. The clip, rough and unedited, was shared across Twitter, now X, TikTok, Reddit music forums, Instagram Reels. Within days, it had millions of views. Major music accounts reposted it. Music historians began writing retrospectives. Reggae playlists updated their covers. No longer just Bob, but now Jacob too. Gen Z, who had grown up hearing Bad Boys in memes and police reality shows, now heard Jacob's voice and asked, "Wait, this is the same band?" Inner Circle's inbox flooded. Legacy media outlets reached out. Producers pitched biopics. Academics requested interviews. A streaming service commissioned a full-scale docuseries on Jamaica's musical revolution. And this time, Inner Circle was at the center. Jacob's voice, unmuted. For the Lewis brothers, it was surreal. After decades of fighting to preserve Jacob's memory, the world had found him, organically, authentically, without being packaged. It wasn't driven by marketing. It was the energy of the footage, the undeniable joy, the voice that needed no auto-tune, the smile that didn't ask for permission to exist. Roger was moved to tears watching a TikTok montage of Jacob cut over protest footage in France. Youth holding signs, chanting "Babylon must fall" as forward Jar Jar children played underneath. "He's more alive now," Roger said, "than in the years just after he passed." And Ian added quietly, "This is the exposure he always deserved. No label, no contracts, just truth." Global honors and cultural restoration. The rediscovery of Jacob had ripple effects. In Jamaica, the Jamaican Ministry of Culture announced a posthumous national honor for Jacob Miller, the Order of Distinction, Commander Class, for his contributions to music and cultural identity. A new mural was painted in Halfway Tree, Jacob's face, alongside Bob Marley, Miss Lou, and Marcus Garvey. Jacob's son, who had remained largely private, gave a rare interview on national television, sharing stories of his father's joy, humor, and spirituality. In Europe, a Berlin Museum of Global Music included a Jacob Miller wing in its Voices of Resistance exhibit. Vinyl reissues of Dread Dread and Jacob Miller and Inner Circle live sold out in days. In Africa, Nigerian and Ghanaian musicians sampled his vocals in Afro-reggae fusions. Jacob's lyrics were quoted in Pan-Africanist speeches and college lectures. On streaming platforms, Tenement Yard entered the global reggae top 10 on Spotify. Inner Circle's Jacob Era catalog saw a 700% spike in plays over 6 months. Jacob wasn't back. He had never truly left. But now, finally, the world was listening properly. Inner Circle recentered. The exposure didn't just revive Jacob. It repositioned Inner Circle exactly where they belonged, not just as crossover artists, but as pioneers. Interviews rolled in. BBC, NPR, Rolling Stone, Jamaican Gleaner and Observer, Caribbean Diaspora podcasts with massive followings. The questions were deeper now. What was it like building reggae beside Marley, not behind him? What did Jacob believe in? Why did it take so long for the world to remember? Inner Circle answered not with bitterness, but with grace. They spoke of cultural memory, the dangers of commercial erasure, the spiritual cost of survival in a system not built to remember black rebels. They didn't demand credit. They simply shared context. New collaborations and the next sound. The exposure led to unexpected alliances. British rapper Stormzy reached out to sample Jacob's vocals. Afrofusion icon Burna Boy proposed a full Inner Circle X Africa EP. Grammy-winning reggae revivalist Protojay requested a circle-style dub of his next single. But the most emotional call came from Damien Jr. Gong Marley. "Uncle Roger," he said, "let's make something Jacob would smile at." Within weeks, Inner Circle and Junior Gong were in the studio, crafting a track that would fuse Jacob's unreleased vocal stems with modern roots instrumentation and Marley's signature lyrical fire. The track, titled Circles Still Turning, was released on Jacob's birthday. It charted globally, but more than that, it felt sacred. A family reunited in sound. The exposure not only restored Jacob's name, it reconnected the circle itself. Former bandmates rejoined for select performances. Calton Coffee, though still battling illness, offered public blessings for the next chapter. The band launched a special Jacob Lives tour with select dates across Jamaica, Europe, and Africa, backed by holographic visuals and narrated interludes. They weren't chasing trends anymore. They were walking in legacy, and fans, old and new, embraced them as elders of the culture, not just performers. The stage became sacred ground again, and the circle turned, not because of marketing, but because of memory. Chapter 15, Revenge, Reclaiming the Narrative and Defending Reggae's Roots. In the music industry, revenge doesn't come through scandal or sabotage. It comes through narrative correction, when a legacy once overlooked is suddenly undeniable. When artists long branded as commercial or secondary rise from the margins and reclaim their place at the center. For Inner Circle, the viral rediscovery of Jacob Miller was more than vindication. It was a trigger. The world was finally listening. And the band, now elders, archivists and survivors, wasn't going to waste the moment. This was not petty revenge. It was cultural revenge. The kind that comes when you've been written out of the textbooks, but your music still lives in every sound system. The kind that comes when your life's work is reduced to a theme song, and then, decades later, rediscovered by youth who see the truth behind the beat. This was retaliation through restoration, and the circle was ready. The battle for reggae's soul. With Jacob's image rising across digital platforms and critical journals, a broader conversation ignited across the reggae landscape. Who controls reggae's global narrative? Who gets remembered? And who gets erased? Inner Circle had felt these tensions for decades. Despite their contributions, they were often excluded from academic panels, museum exhibits, and curated playlists that focus primarily on Marley, Tosh, and Cliff. Now, the imbalance was being called out, not just by the band, but by fans, cultural historians, and younger artists. Caribbean writers penned op-eds, "Reggae is not a one-man legacy." Diaspora DJs ran tribute specials. "Give the circle their flowers while they can still smell them." Social media buzzed with debates about industry gatekeeping, media misrepresentation, and the dangers of letting foreign corporations curate black music history. And in the middle of it, all stood in a circle, not angry, but activated. The return to Kingston, on their terms. In 2024, the band announced something that many thought would never happen. A full-length, all-original Inner Circle album, recorded in Kingston. Not Miami, not LA, but back where it all started. The album would be titled Zion Circle. It was a deliberate move. Recorded at Tuff Gong Studios, using analog gear and live takes. Featuring guest vocals from Jamaican elders and next-gen stars alike. No label oversight. Fully independent. Fully spiritual. The band returned to Trenchtown, Waterhouse, and even the tenement yards that inspired their early hits. They recorded ambient sounds, wind through zinc fences, church bells, children playing. This wasn't nostalgia. It was reclamation. They were bringing the circle home and inviting the world to witness it. The lyrics turned sharper. Unlike their smoother pop reggae hits of the 90s, Zion Circle was uncompromising. Tracks included Echoes of Jacob, a haunting chant-like meditation on prophecy, betrayal, and eternal return. Algorithm Babylon, a fiery takedown of digital erasure, corporate streaming models, and the datafication of black art. Marley Wasn't Alone, a controversial but truthful acknowledgement that reggae's foundation was collective, not singular. We Still Dea, a chant of resilience, featuring a choir of Caribbean youth, reciting Jacob Miller quotes. It was bold, it was raw, it was necessary, and it made waves. Critical acclaim and cultural pushback. Zion Circle dropped to critical acclaim across both reggae and global music press. Rolling Stone hailed it as a sonic homecoming, spiritual, political, and deeply Caribbean. The Guardian called it the album Inner Circle always wanted to make, but never had the industry support to release. Reggae historians labeled it a corrective strike, but not everyone embraced it. Some Jamaican media elites pushed back, accusing the band of stirring division. Why go after Marley now? Why bring politics back into the music? Inner Circle responded the only way they knew how, through rhythm and message. Roger Lewis said in a press conference, "We're not dissing Bob. We love Bob. But we're here to remind the world he didn't do it alone. And Jacob never got his justice." And Ian added, "This album isn't about revenge on people. It's revenge on the system that decides who gets remembered and who gets erased." The next generation joins the fight. Perhaps the most beautiful consequence of Zion Circle was how it galvanized youth. Caribbean Gen Z creators began posting reaction videos to Jacob Miller's live footage, analyzing Inner Circle's lyrics on TikTok, sampling their music in lo-fi edits, Afrobeat remixes, and drill beats. New Jamaican artists cited Inner Circle as direct inspiration, including a Kingston-born rapper blending dub and trap, a Dominican-Jamaican singer creating Circle Soul, reggae-infused R&B, a visual artist staging a gallery exhibit titled Tenement God, a tribute to Jacob's image and energy. The Circle was no longer just a band. It had become a template, a cultural blueprint. Revenge achieved without violence. Inner Circle's revenge didn't come through confrontation. It came through recentering Jacob Miller as a global prophet, demanding proper archival of reggae's full story, releasing one of their most critically respected albums, galvanizing a cultural awakening among youth. It was sweet. It was sacred. It was long overdue. And as the album climbed the world music charts, the band didn't celebrate with champagne or Instagram lives. Instead, they returned to the studio, barefoot, laughing, smiling, and began working on the next project. Because the circle doesn't stop, it turns, always. Chapter 16, The Setup, laying the foundation for a permanent cultural institution. By 2025, Inner Circle had done more than reclaim their legacy. They had become a living institution. But institutions, like roots, need grounding, not just in rhythm, not just in memory, but in structure. The music had been their weapon, the message, their mission. Now it was time to build something that would outlive them, something that could protect and preserve and propagate everything Inner Circle had stood for across 5 decades. They had been the voice of Kingston, the bridge to global reggae, the surviving torchbearers of Jacob Miller's fire. But if that fire was to burn beyond their lifetimes, they needed to build the heart that would hold it. And so began the most ambitious phase of their journey, the setup of the Inner Circle Cultural Legacy Trust. A legacy bigger than music. The idea wasn't new. Roger and Ian had spoken of it for years, back when Circle House Studios first opened its doors in Miami in the early 90s. But back then, it was just a dream. Now, with renewed global respect, critical momentum, and a generation of artists looking to them for guidance, the moment had finally arrived. The goal, to institutionalize the Circle, not as a brand, not as a museum piece, but as a permanent cultural force. The Inner Circle Cultural Legacy Trust would focus on 5 pillars: preservation, archiving music, videos, interviews, unreleased demos, and historical materials from Inner Circle, Jacob Miller, and reggae pioneers often overlooked. Education, launching programs in Jamaica, the Caribbean, and diaspora schools teaching reggae history, sound system culture, and the philosophy of Caribbean resistance through music. Creation, funding and producing new work from emerging artists aligned with the band's values. Cultural truth tellers, not just entertainers. Access, establishing a digital and physical portal to the archives, ensuring that future generations can study and experience reggae's roots without corporate distortion. Advocacy, working with UNESCO and Jamaican cultural bodies to protect reggae as intellectual property and prevent its erasure or dilution by the global industry. This wasn't about nostalgia. This was infrastructure. The Jacob Miller Archives. The first phase of the trust was the most sacred, the Jacob Miller Archives. Inner Circle had long possessed hundreds of hours of rare footage, audio stems, handwritten lyrics, and unreleased studio takes from Jacob's brief but explosive reign. Until now, most of it had been stored in analog formats, scattered across vaults in Kingston, Miami, and London. Now, with the help of archivists, sound engineers, and cultural preservationists, the material was being digitized, cataloged, and curated. Plans were announced for a Jacob Miller Multimedia Museum exhibit to debut in Kingston before traveling globally. A documentary series featuring rare rehearsal footage, unseen interviews, and behind-the-scenes tour clips. A coffee table biography, pairing photos with essays from peers like Jimmy Cliff, Bunny Wailer, Archived, and Jacob's family. The process was personal. Roger would sometimes weep in the studio, hearing Jacob's isolated vocals, laughter between takes, spiritual chants no one had heard in 40 years. "It's like he's still guiding us," Ian said, still smiling. Global partners, local soul. The trust found eager partners across the world. Harvard University offered a partnership through its Caribbean Studies division. Spotify committed funding to help with audio restoration. UNESCO granted preliminary support for Inner Circle's application to have Jacob Miller and Inner Circle's contributions added to the intangible cultural heritage list. But the band was cautious. They had spent decades fighting for independence. They refused to let outside forces commodify Jacob or dilute their intentions. So they made one thing clear in every contract. This is for Jamaica. This is for the Caribbean. This is for the children of sound. They hired Caribbean lawyers, worked with Rasta elders, brought in teachers, youth workers, even elders from Niabingi orders. This wasn't a corporate archive. It was a spiritual one. Education built on rhythm. At the heart of the Legacy Trust was the belief that music is education, especially for youth disillusioned by traditional systems. The Trust launched the Sound Circle Academy, a youth music mentorship program based in Spanish Town and Miami Gardens, teaching reggae history, sound system operation, beat making, and lyrical storytelling. Mobile reggae labs, buses fitted with studio equipment, sent into underserved neighborhoods across the Caribbean and diaspora to deliver music education directly to youth. The Jacob Miller Scholarship for students pursuing studies in cultural preservation, music production, or Caribbean arts history. These weren't PR stunts. They were long-term investments. Inner Circle was no longer just a band. They were a curriculum. The Circle House expansion. Circle House Studios also received a physical and philosophical expansion. The newly constructed Circle House East opened in Kingston in 2025, just blocks from Jacob's childhood yard. It included a recording studio with analog and digital options, a media classroom and editing suite, a small performance venue for youth showcases, poetry nights, and community reasoning sessions. A mural corridor honoring Caribbean music legends, from Count Ossie to Sister Nancy. And at the center, a statue of Jacob, barefoot, arms open, smiling wide. Industry shifts and cultural power. The creation of the Inner Circle Cultural Legacy Trust also sent ripples through the music industry. Other reggae veterans began forming their own archives. Festivals began paying proper tribute. Streaming platforms created curated by Inner Circle sections. A new ethos was taking hold. Protect your culture. Don't wait for the industry to validate you. Inner Circle had set the precedent. And in doing so, they had begun shaping not just their legacy, but reggae's future sovereignty. The setup complete. By the close of 2025, Inner Circle had performed fewer shows, but made a bigger impact than in decades. Their setup was complete, cultural trust established, archives digitized, studios expanded, curriculum launched, global institutions aligned. They had done what few artists ever could. They didn't just make music, they built a legacy strong enough to protect it. The circle had shifted from movement to monument, not as an ending, but as a foundation for everything yet to come. Chapter 17, The Betrayal, Corporate Exploitation, and the Fight for Ownership. They had faced exile, censorship, and the heartbreak of Jacob Miller's death, but nothing wounded Inner Circle like this. Not in the way that made them question the very industry they had helped to build. It didn't come with gunshots or riots. It came in the form of a licensing agreement, what was supposed to be a celebratory box set, a high-fidelity vinyl remaster of Inner Circle's early recordings, had morphed, behind closed doors, into a global remix campaign. Jacob Miller's voice was stripped from its spiritual roots and cut into dance tracks, marketed at European festivals as tropical beats with a vintage edge. No history, no message, no acknowledgement of the Caribbean struggle that birthed it. And worst of all, they had signed it away. A clause hidden in plain sight. Roger Lewis stared at the fine print of the contract they'd approved 6 months earlier. Somewhere in a sea of boilerplate was a single clause. The licensee reserves the right to creatively reinterpret original content for the purpose of genre-specific adaptation. It had sounded harmless at the time. Standard industry language. Their legal team hadn't flagged it, but the label had used it to remix, rebrand, and redistribute Inner Circle's roots music without consulting them once. The sacred had become soundbites. The rebel had been made into a ringtone, and just like that, the fight wasn't about money anymore. It was about dignity, cultural memory. It was about Jacob. Digital desecration. The worst offense came when a German EDM group released a track titled Ja Vibes, featuring Jacob M. Featuring a sped-up sample of Jacob Miller chanting, "Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement yard." The track had charted on Spotify's global chillwave playlist, promoted alongside electronic producers who couldn't find Jamaica on a map. It went viral, not because people cared about Jacob Miller, but because of the beat drop. Roger was livid. Ian was silent for 2 full days. "This is erasure," Roger said during a private band meeting. "This is not what we stood for. This is not what Jacob died for." The legal retaliation. They move fast. A cease and desist, then a lawsuit. $35 million in damages, filed in 3 countries. They weren't just suing for breach of contract. They were suing for cultural desecration. They brought in Caribbean copyright experts, ethnomusicologists from the University of the West Indies, UNESCO consultants on intangible heritage. Their case was clear. Reggae is not a genre for exploitation. It's a spiritual archive of a colonized people's resistance. In press conferences, Roger and Ian refused to smile. "This isn't about nostalgia," Roger told Al Jazeera. "It's about memory. It's about ownership of our story." The industry's divide. Not everyone stood with them. Some younger dancehall and trap reggae artists accused Inner Circle of gatekeeping, arguing that music should evolve, not be frozen in tradition. The media ran with it. Are reggae pioneers holding back the future? Old lions versus new waves. The ownership debate in Caribbean music. But behind the scenes, veterans like Jimmy Cliff, Burning Spear, and Damian Marley offered quiet solidarity. So did Buju Banton. So did Protoj. "Music can evolve," Ian told one interviewer, "but it must never forget to who gave it breath." Turning pain into policy. Out of the betrayal came action. Inner Circle expanded the Inner Circle Cultural Legacy Trust to include legal defense funds for young Caribbean artists entering contracts, workshops on licensing, publishing, and cultural ethics, a campaign titled Not for Remix that educated artists about intellectual property and spiritual sovereignty. They even partnered with Spotify and Tidal on their own terms to release annotated versions of their classic albums with cultural context, original liner notes, and Jacob's voice unedited. They weren't just fighting back. They were training others how to fight. Courtroom victory and a new precedent. In early 2027, the court ruled in Inner Circle's favor. The Remix label was ordered to pull all unauthorized content from platforms, pay damages and legal fees, issue a public apology, submit to cultural training through UNESCO. But the true victory wasn't the payout. It was the precedent. For the first time, a Caribbean music legacy had been legally recognized as cultural property, not just commercial entertainment. Redemption in the fire. The betrayal had lit a fire in the band. They knew now that preserving a legacy wasn't just about storytelling or archiving. It was about defending it. And in that courtroom, for the first time since Jacob's passing, they felt as though he was truly with them, not as a relic, not as a memory, but as a living truth they had fought to protect. As Roger said in the press conference following the ruling, Jacob's voice lives, but it won't live in silence. It'll live in the fight. Chapter 18, The Confrontation, Industry Giants, Cultural Lines, and Global Reckoning. After the courtroom victory, most artists would have celebrated quietly, maybe toured, maybe retired. Not Inner Circle. Their legal win against Remix exploitation wasn't a finale. It was a starting pistol. Because while they'd just beaten one label in court, the real confrontation was global. And the gatekeepers, billion-dollar tech platforms. Name in the names. Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, each had profited from reggae without ever crediting its roots. Monetizing chopped up Jacob Miller vocals, auto-generating island vibes, playlists with no historical context, promoting watered-down dancehall under tags like Beach Party Beats. Inner Circle went public, not with anger, but with precision. They released an open letter signed by over 300 Caribbean artists, including Chronix, Coffee, Taris Riley, Damian Marley, and Barris Hammond. The demands were simple: metadata reform, no more mislabeling Caribbean genres, cultural consultants for playlist curation, transparency around royalties and algorithms. The industry reacts. At first, silence. Then came the corporate diplomacy. We are proud to support music from around the world and are reviewing our genre tagging systems, Spotify spokesperson. But Inner Circle had already mobilized. They launched Number Reggae is Resistance, a viral campaign pairing archival footage of Jacob Miller with modern protest imagery and testimonials from Caribbean artists. The short doc Who Owns the Vibe dropped on YouTube, narrated by Yendi Phillips, directed by Storm Salter. 10 million views in 4 days. The confrontation had become a movement. Flashpoints around the world. Global ripple effects followed. London, Notting Hill Carnival added a panel on digital exploitation. Ghana, radio debates erupted around Afro-Caribbean intellectual property. New York, diaspora youth launched Number Roots Not Filters, flooding TikTok with stories of stolen sounds. This was no longer just about Inner Circle. It was about the global South reclaiming its voice. Sitting at the table. Behind the scenes, Inner Circle began direct negotiations with streaming giants. Ian Lewis proposed a Caribbean Cultural Advisory Board. Roger Lewis demanded algorithmic reform to prioritize authentic roots music. Spotify agreed to co-curate a flagship playlist, Roots, Resistance, and Rhythm. Apple Music initiated metadata corrections across over 5,000 reggae tracks. Not a full revolution, but a first step toward respect. Changing the game. Inner Circle expanded their imprint Circle House into a watchdog agency, monitoring AI remixes, metadata abuse, and unauthorized samples. They launched Circle Digital Academy, teaching young Caribbean artists how to code, publish independently, retain ownership of their work. They no longer just archived reggae's past, they were shaping its future. We don't need a seat at their table. We'll build our own table, and they'll ask to sit at ours. Roger Lewis. The global recognition. 1 year later, vindication came. Bad Boys was added to the UNESCO Memory of the World Register. Jacob Miller posthumously received the Global Heritage Award for Cultural Voice. Circle House was declared a Caribbean Digital Heritage Landmark. At the celebration in Kingston, Roger addressed a new generation of artists. They tried to make us background music. We became a movement, and now we're the blueprint. The confrontation had redefined reggae's global narrative, not as a genre for export, but as a cultural fortress, protected, honored, and owned. Chapter 19, The Collapse. Old industry cracks, new movements rise. The global music industry didn't implode overnight. It fractured, slowly, quietly, like a skyscraper with hidden rust behind its polished facade. Inner Circle didn't cause the collapse, but they were the tremor that exposed the fault lines. By 2026, the model that once dictated Caribbean musical identity to the world had begun to dismantle itself, under pressure, scrutiny, and truth. When the algorithms fell silent. Streaming giants had always been silent gods, deciding what rose and what vanished. But in the wake of Inner Circle's movement, something changed. TikTok influencers stopped using reggae remix filters and started crediting original tracks. Spotify's back-end data showed a 300% rise in plays of roots reggae from the 1970s. YouTube creators, once quick to capitalize on dancehall aesthetics, began citing cultural consultants in their content. And the most telling sign? Labels quietly began removing unauthorized remixes of Jacob Miller's voice. Not because they were forced, but because the cultural backlash made them radioactive. Cracks in the colonial pipeline. For decades, Caribbean music had passed through a colonial distribution funnel. Recorded in the islands, mastered in Miami, owned in London, monetized in Los Angeles. But now, independent distributors started to bloom. Root Signal, a Jamaican-owned digital aggregator, began onboarding hundreds of artists. Trinidad launched Pantrack, the first pan-Caribbean publishing rights database. Barbados piloted a reggae blockchain project, issuing digital proof of authorship for unreleased music archives. The collapse wasn't about destruction. It was about liberation. Inner Circle's role in the shift. They didn't sit back and watch. They stepped in. Circle Digital opened satellite hubs in Kingston, Nassau, and Accra, teaching rights management, AI music defense, and licensing. They funded the first Caribbean AI tool trained solely on authentic reggae, mento, ska, and dub rhythms. Roger and Ian co-founded the Dub Trust, a legal and financial firm dedicated to protecting the estates of late reggae icons like Sugar Minot, Ken Booth, and Sister Nancy. Every rhythm we lost, we're taking it back, legally and spiritually. Ian Lewis. Industry exodus. Younger artists began turning down major label deals. Coffee rejected a seven-figure offer from a U.S. label in favor of a co-op contract with Root Signal. A viral artist in St. Lucia demanded 50% ownership of his masters and got it, thanks to the legal framework pioneered by the Dub Trust. Major labels watched, confused. They tried to rebrand. We stand with island artistry. But the internet wasn't buying it. A viral video of a music exec dancing offbeat at Notting Hill Carnival while wearing a Roots shirt became a meme. When you monetize the revolution but don't know the beat, the fall of the old gatekeepers. By 2027, Former powerhouses began to shrink. VP Records sold its catalog rights back to several Jamaican families. Two major Caribbean radio conglomerates merged into a youth-led co-op. Billboard introduced a new chart, Global Heritage Sounds, with a Caribbean advisory board. An Inner Circle? They weren't charting. They were changing the criteria for what charts even meant. Legacy in motion. As the old systems crumbled, new ones rose, rooted in history, but forward-looking. A Netflix-style platform called Island Archive launched, streaming reggae documentaries, live concert recordings, and remastered vinyl cuts. The University of the West Indies partnered with Circle House to launch the Jacob Miller Cultural Studies program, offering courses on music, activism, and diasporic identity. Children in rural Jamaica were learning coding, not just drumming, but both were treated as equal tools of liberation. "It's not about preserving what we had," said Roger Lewis in a BBC interview. "It's about evolving what we are, with power, with memory, with rhythm." One final collapse. In late 2027, Billboard released a controversial editorial declaring, "Reggae's golden age is over." The backlash was immediate, but Inner Circle didn't rage. They posted a simple image on their socials, a photo of Jacob Miller, grinning wide, standing barefoot in a field of children. The caption read, "Over. It just reached your ears. We've been vibrating for generations." The collapse wasn't about endings. It was about who got to tell the story next. Chapter 20, Legacy. What Inner Circle built for the world to inherit. It didn't end with a last concert. There was no grand farewell tour, no final album to close the curtain, because Inner Circle never stopped playing. But what they left behind, what they built, was far greater than records or royalties. It was a living legacy, a blueprint for resistance through rhythm, for memory, through melody. It was the kind of legacy that outlives flesh and becomes folklore. The beat that built bridges. Inner Circle's music had always transcended the stage. Bad Boys became more than a theme song. It became a cultural mirror. Tenement Yard became a global chant for dignity in poverty. Forward Jar Jar Children became an anthem on African student uprisings. In South Africa, classrooms chanted Jacob Miller's lyrics during youth protests. In Brazil, favelas painted murals of Ian and Raja alongside Bob Marley and Peter Tosh. In Germany, refugee camps blasted Inner Circle tracks through tin speakers wired with hope. The music didn't just entertain, it reminded people that they existed. Circle House becomes a living archive. What began as a Miami studio became something else entirely. Circle House transformed into a reggae innovation lab, a youth mentorship hub, a digital rights watchdog, a living museum. Its walls echoed not only with bass lines and guitar licks, but with the voices of survivors, scholars, and students preserving their truth through sound. Every Friday, children gathered in the courtyard to play steel pan and chant dub poetry. Every wall bore handwritten lyrics. Every hallway smelled of wood, incense, and coffee. It wasn't polished. It was alive. Beyond the music, foundations and futures. They launched the Jacob Miller Foundation, focusing on music therapy for trauma survivors, scholarships for Caribbean music students, archiving oral histories from elders of the reggae movement. They also helped co-found the International Black Sonic Archives, an alliance of institutions preserving African and Afro-Caribbean audio legacies threatened by neglect or theft. Inner Circle had become custodians of culture, not just creators of it. Family, then and now. Legacy isn't always abstract. Sometimes it lives in the blood. Ian Lewis's grandson, Jahari, became a celebrated ethnomusicologist. Roger Lewis's daughter, Mikalia, founded the first reggae animation series for children. Circle House's board now included descendants of former band members, Jacob Miller's family, and young artists from rural Jamaica, Haiti, and St. Vincent. Each generation carried a fragment of the flame. Each added their own verse to the song. "Our legacy is unfinished," said Ian, in a rare speech at the United Nations Cultural Forum. "And that's the point. The fire should never go out." Global recognition, local roots. They received every honor imaginable. Lifetime achievement from the Grammys. Induction into the Reggae Hall of Fame. UN citation for cultural diplomacy. But when asked what meant the most, Roger always pointed to one thing. The murals in Trenchtown. The youth in Tivoli Gardens recording on our old mic. The festival in Montego Bay where every act is independent. Because for Inner Circle, legacy wasn't about looking back. It was about making sure the youth could look forward and see themselves. A final scene. In 2028, on a humid summer evening in Kingston, a new artist took the stage. He wore no shoes. His band had no label, and his first song sampled a Jacob Miller vocal, legally cleared, spiritually protected. As he sang, the crowd of thousands erupted, not because it was nostalgic, but because it felt true. And in the back, under dim stage lights, Ian and Roger stood together, smiling, not for the past, not for the fame, but for the circle that had finally closed and begun again.